So this presentation is really triggered by the wave of revival of prosecutions and past human rights violations, which has really swept at least the southern cone of Latin America since the mid-1990s. And what that looks like is now, for example, we have 1,300 former military and security officers being investigated, 50 sentenced, and 44 on the run. Chile has 257 now final sentences, and about 600 former military officers under active investigation. And we're just seeing in Uruguay the first cases of a similar kind. Ordinary transitional justice theory did not expect this and did not predict this, and almost two decades after transition. It was believed that what we did at the beginning was enough to finish the issue in whatever way. So the question really that this raises is, what is this about? What is this about, and is it likely to happen elsewhere? Is this something very particular to Latin America, or is it telling us something about how these debates look at a certain distance from transition, which is what we have available to look at in Latin America a little bit more than elsewhere? So let's just look at very quickly at what we're talking about. What we're talking about in terms of the Southern Cone is really amnesty for impunity, in terms of these different kinds of impunity and what they amnesty and what they were used for. In Central America, we have much more of a situation where amnesty was offered as a necessary or believed to be necessary condition for achieving peace. But in the Southern Cone, it's clearly not that. It's clearly amnesty after the fact. It's clearly one-sided amnesty that's really designed to protect regime members. These patterns obviously are important when it comes to how you dismantle these legacies at a later date. This is the role of disarmament. This is what the patterns look like in Latin America and Central America in terms of what we're actually discussing. And this is background, so unfortunately I have to skip through. As I said, I hope this will be available and I can make it available to people who want it. When we come to why things changed, why did we even get transition? Again, I think this is important. In the Southern Cone, we have economically and political reasons why the regimes are no longer viable. There is human rights opposition as part of that discourse, but it's important that it's not true that this is about the way transition happened, particularly in the Southern Cone. There was no lasting consensus about the rejection of the regime or the rejection of the human rights grants. They needed to go for other reasons in some cases. I think this is an important distinction I'm starting to perceive with some of the other settings. When apartheid fell, it had no serious defenders. When Soviet socialism fell, it had not either. But Latin American military regimes continued in many cases to have civilian defenders, and even, as in the case of Chile, very high levels of internal political support after transition. So these are regimes that go for other reasons, not really because there's a unified consensus about the undesirability of what they did in the human rights sphere. In Latin America, it's the usual triad, the truth, justice, reconciliation, justice in brackets, and we'll see really why that should be. So truth commissions, the first truth commissions were not in South Africa, they were in Latin America. Here we have the cover of the Chilean report, but in fact the first one was Argentina, Juan Alec, in 1985 and 6. Justice, we have the negational justice, in my view, in terms of amnesty. Something around lustration, something around class. Reconciliation more ends up being treated under the heading of reparations, which is a very different dynamic. This is not, therefore, perpetrator victim. It becomes a state victim dynamic. What did all of this actually achieve? Truth, yes, had its... it was very important, certainly in the situation where the regime tactics included official denial, official negation, silence. It's important not to underestimate the value of the same state which carried out repressions, acknowledging finally the truth of those things. But genuine revelations are very few in the case of Latin America. This is one of the places where repression was almost uniquely documented as it when it happened. There was already a paper trail, certainly in the case of Chile and the rest of the Southern Cone. And what this is really about is acknowledgement, state acknowledgement of some of what went on. But in terms of, again, it's the levels of consensus around this and the levels of consensus around the undesirability of this and the repudiation of this, we would have to question how far that was really the case. The Chilean Supreme Court said the Truth Commission was tendentious. The Salvadoran Supreme Court and military rejected it outright. Very recently, we've had the Peruvian Cardinal lambasting the Truth Commissioners in Peru for defaming the army and bringing their position. In terms of justice, formal prosecutions were largely considered either impossible or unwise, and what we have is a very widespread pattern of amnesty. Some kind of lustration measure, I'm borrowing the term, was tried only in El Salvador under the UN-sponsored commission, which was supposed to be able to make binding recommendations. Some of the high command was forced to retire, but those and accompanied by bans on running for political office and holding public office. Those bans were overturned, and it's very common to read about El Salvador what the Truth Commission recommended, as if that was what in fact happened, and that's not the case. One or two or three months after the commission recommendation, many of the people involved went to court and argued that this was a violation of their political rights, given that they had never been put through any sort of judicial process. Now, the reason they weren't put through a judicial process was the very broad, sweeping amnesty, which followed 2 days quite on the heels of the Truth Commission report, and of course that dynamic was not considered. So it's important to say that what we think we've got and what we actually got were very different in some cases. And only Argentina did we initially get trans, who's the child of the original juntas in 1985. Reconciliation, as I've said, usually becomes reparations quite quickly, very quickly. And then the delivery of those is also a problem. We've had much better delivery of reparations to former combatants in Central America than we have had to victims, civilian victims. We've had virtually nothing in Peru as well. So delivery is a problem. So is this notion of community reparations. Individual versus community each has its own problems. Individual economic reparations have caused huge amounts of tensions and social resentment. But collective reparations, which are recommended at community level in Peru, of course, a similar kind of distinction, where what you're getting is very basic development goals being met by the government as if they were a reparation money. So in the same communities, a village which what's considered to be political rights will get its water supply, will get its primary school, and not based on that evaluation, and surrounding communities will be left out of that. So obviously that's a problem. That's the good thing. Okay, what we got in terms of truth and justice initially, so this is, we're still in the looking very far too quickly at what happened in the immediate transitional period. Truth Commission, TC, News Truth Commission, they're not always state, three of them are and one not. Here, and as you can see the pattern, this is chronological. Amnesty, Charles become amnesty in Argentina, and that lesson, that negative lesson is learned by other experiences very quickly that you can't supposedly carry out Charles, and therefore amnesty. In the case of Brazil, it's a de facto revenue, they do the amnesty, which is why it's in brackets there. As time goes by, Guatemala and Peru, interestingly, the more recent cases, the kinds of international limitations we heard about are at least narrowing the scope of amnesty. And in the case of Peru, of course, we didn't have an amnesty law. We had the overturning of Peru, which was an attack itself, amnesty. And recently, we've had a historic trial and conviction. But the Latin America export model, this is what went around the world, and this is what went to South Africa. You know, the amount of involvement, direct involvement of Chileans in the Truth and South African Commission of the Latin Americans was very high. You have this truth justice trade-off that I mentioned. Commissions, yes, you have them, and then you have impunity. Before that, you have it in some cases, and immediately afterwards in many cases. Reconciliation becomes a thing the state does with victims. The idea of getting the repressors in to acknowledge or to come some way towards meeting the victims, I think, is abandoned quite quickly. And the notion that the democracy you're looking for is really institutional engineering. What you do is you get the framework right, and the rest will have to wait. We'll see later what we do with all these things. And how did that work? The outcomes, yes, formal democracy was largely secured in Latin America. So 2006, we had big women elections for the first time ever in Latin America. Elected presidents took over from previously elected presidents in the whole of the region except for Cuba. That's not an inconsiderable achievement. How much of this is down to amnesty or just down to transitional justice or the way it was done? A very, very, very logical point there. But from that point on, the depth and quality of democracy does become an issue, and this transitional justice debate is part, I think, of that discussion. The right very much wins the ideological battle, even in cases where right-wing authoritarians left power in Latin America. They often didn't travel very far. And in the southern cone, their market models, their economic models were retained, as was the constitution they wrote in the case of Chile. In Central America, you often had no political replacement at all. So transition in El Salvador, Arena, which is the party founded by a despot member, presided over the peace accord and has also presided over all subsequent administrations until very recently, last month, when we had political replacement. And again, obviously, that's important when you look at whether or how and why these issues re-emerged by the state business. Is there really political replacement as part of transition? So then we get to what I'm really trying to explain or trying to look at, which is post-transitional justice question mark. This is my turn, not everyone can agree with it. But this notion that from the 1990s we clearly start to see a renewed demand in Latin America for addressing these justice legacies and putting right some of what was not done. What does this look like? It's civil society, it's not the state. And I think this is really important. States never, almost never revisit these settlements unless you make them do so. And transitional justice, I think, is a field that's often behaved as if transitional justice is essentially something states do. It's a state decision to do it or not to do it. What we're starting to see in Latin America is that may not always be the case. There is, in particular, the civil law system in Latin America does allow private groups a role in even in justice processes. So sources that you can trigger investigations and prosecutions in ways that they can't certainly under the British legal system. Usually in minority interests, it doesn't seem to be the case that you need to develop a great head of steam in society and consensus that this needs to be readdressed. It seems to be enough, and that's part of the judicialization group. That's what you do if you're a minority group about all kinds of issues, is you use the avenue available. And if the avenue available is not 50% multiple plus one, we're seeing people going to and using the voice. Just to say that this kind of whole demand of what we're seeing, Juan Mendes said that on the 10th anniversary of the Pinochet arrest, Juan Mendes said that, what does Latin America show? 25 years ago, they told us in Latin America we have to choose between democracy and justice. And today, Latin America, he says, is showing the world that you maybe can have both. So this is what some of what's going on. There's a very strong justice focus to this, as the obvious first step, partly because of amnesty. Amnesty is a political settlement that takes place in legal terrain, and it almost obliges you, really, if you want to move on further justice to go through the courts. But there are also very, very important symbolic dimensions to this, positive memorialization. And what I call anti-memorials. Anti-memorials are things that turn the gaze to 180 degrees in Latin America from this focus on the dead and the disappeared, the absent victims, firstly to survivors, to present victims, who are the people who are pushing and much more active and much more complicated, if you like, when they're going to the court and pushing for this. But also, eventually, through survivors to perpetrators. What does post-transitional justice look like in Latin America? This is a recovered site in Chile. And this is what I talk about with the anti-memorial, the idea that one of the things you do is to start to point out who are the perpetrators and where they are and what they're now doing. It's interesting, this is the aesthetic we're very used to seeing with the where are they disappeared. This is the thing that Latin America is kind of really identified for. What you now have is the symbolism, which is the same kind of symbolism, but these are the perpetrators. So this is a group called Funan, there's a similar group in Argentina with the Gratis who identify, they out for the perpetrators. They find where these people are, they go to their homes, they go to their workplaces, and they say, do you know who these people are? Do you know who you're living next door to? Do you know who you're working with? And their view is, if there aren't formal justice processes, there'll be these kinds of informal justice processes. Whereas here, this kind of broad post-transitional justice that's not only about child, and I think that's important to know, is commemorative, it has that idea. So here we're back with the focus on the absent, the dead and disappeared. But it's also very contestatory. Hijos means sons, and daughters, hijos is the children, and now some cases the grandchildren of the disappeared. And they're the ones who are taking this rather more radical approach of being out in the streets and denouncing for the perpetrators where formal justice has not happened. These graffiti say, no forgiveness, no forgetting, on the left-hand side from Chile, and on the right-hand side, similarly, in Argentina, no forgiveness, no reconciliation, and that's signed by hijos. This is the main court building in Santiago, and again, a protest taking place around Rio and some of those judicial trials. So it's a very contested, it's a very messy, it's a very kind of out in the street process. And this, well beyond the kind of formalities of it, is some of the problems the state has with it. This is why I say all governments have been reluctant to revisit this, basically just because this is something they don't want to see, almost irrespective of their position on particular issues. What have been the causes of these kinds of things? What seems to be behind some of the dynamics why this is coming together at a certain time? There's never one single cause for any of these things, but some of the factors we see it. Anniversaries. Anniversaries seem to be something that gets produces a kind of a move towards revisitation. In 96 in Argentina, the 20th anniversary of the coup, there's always a march, there's always a demonstration. It had got very small. There was something about the 20th anniversary that really struck a chord with people, and there was a huge demonstration, much bigger even than the organizers expecting, and that in turn had not been effective, which I talked about. Similarly, in 1998, it was a huge kind of symbolic year in Chile, well before anything about London and Pinochet being arrested in Spain ever happened. This was the 25th anniversary of the coup. Pinochet was due to retire from the army in early 1998 and to become a senator, and that was all the trigger for a lot of the domestic processes that were magnified but weren't started by his October 1998 detention, spectacularly in London. So the kind of incidental, I think it's important not to forget the incidental and the accidental factors. I think lawyers like to think it's all about accidental in cases, but that's not only why these things happen. So in the case of the Pinochet case, the famous case in Spain, Castresana, Carlos Castresana is the fiscal who brought the original complaint in Spain in 1996, which led to Pinochet being arrested in Malta in 1998. If you ask him why he did that, he'll tell you it's because he saw on TV this huge demonstration I've talked about in 1996 around the 20th anniversary of the coup, and knowing nothing really about the Latin American setting, he said, well, this is clearly something that is close. This is an issue that I want to do something, I want to find out more. So a very kind of direct and very almost incidental connection between that and what subsequently leads to Pinochet's arrest. The superjudge syndrome, this idea that this is all triggered in Orban by the Garzón and things like that, they're there, but they're not the only reason these things have happened. Fujimori, for some reason that we've still yet to really discover, decides, you know, in the course of his preparation for his great political return, decides to fly to Chile, is extradited from Chile to Peru, things you would never have been able to predict. And I think this is really important, not just as a kind of reminder to us that not everything is you know, we can put into our categories, but also kind of for actors and people who are looking to engage in these kind of processes, is to say things will happen that you didn't expect. And the point is maybe to be prepared for those kinds of eventualities and have an idea of how and what use you want to make of them. So if you can't see where change is going to come, where shifts are going to come in terms of change, I think Latin America shows us that shifts do come. In one way or another, whether it's very structured, strategic things, or whether it's things like that. So those country litigation, the Pinochet case, and all the repercussions, you know, I won't go into something David's talking about in the parallel session, but this is another factor. Third country litigation has been important but not determinant, I would say, in many of the cases. Clearly in Chile it had its kind of maximum expression. So,
you have 3 minutes to talk into it.
Catch the Garzón effect then. So these are factors we need to include in our explanation, our array of explanations of why things are moving in Latin America. A colleague of mine said the Pinochet effect is best summed up as the bankruptcy of luxury travel agencies. It's more former dictators have started to stay home for their holidays. That's one of the things we may have achieved. And from the US, interestingly, we may be about to see the first ever expulsion of former Salvadoran generals who've been found liable in civil cases for human rights violations. So the most we've been able to achieve with those civil cases is to get them back to El Salvador, something for which the Salvadoran human rights organizations are only partially grateful. It means that they have begun to coexist with these people. The Garzón effect says what you see is a kind of salutary lesson for Latin American judges, for Chilean judges in particular, of seeing their Spanish counterparts, seeing the judicial actors in the form of colonial power acting decisively over human rights and acting decisively to great popular acclaim. So that the idea is that Chilean judges, local judges in general, inspired and or offended by the implication that they've been somehow lacking in their duties or are kind of given a new impulse to these issues back at home. And I do think that is one important factor. So if you talk to judges and prosecutors, they're very much aware of that as a pressure. And the other is unanswered questions. This is one of the other reasons that things start to move in Central America and in Peru. Exhumations and identification of victims is still an issue. We still don't know the full dimensions of what went on. It's very striking that in Peru, the worst case estimates by the human rights organizations during the political violence were never more than half what was eventually found to be the victim toll by the Truth Commission. And Carlos Manigregri, one of the Truth Commissions, is a very striking thing that he always comes back to, is this idea that how could nearly 40,000 people disappear in a country and no one even noticed? And this has been very much brought home to them. Some of the fractures that underlay the balance. So this is one of the things, the exhumations and the ongoing investigations that has also contributed to this reopening the issue. But if unanswered questions are the problem, then you might say, well, is more truth enough? Maybe we don't need late justice. Maybe what we just need is more complete truth. Maybe we just need to keep going and invent more and new and bigger and better truth measures. And this is one of the things that happened in Chile, something called the Mesa de Diálogo, the Round Table, after Pinochet's arrest. The government decided, well, if the issue is the disappeared and where are they, and this had always been the demand, we'll need to sit down with the lawyers and we'll find out where they are. We'll have a new truth measure, we'll discover the location of the remaining disappeared, and that will be enough. So you know, there's always this idea with the state responsibility, let's just find the next thing that's enough for you to put this issue back to rest. They do all of this, they find out something, very unsatisfactory information about that, but it is not enough to head off the issue. And I think there's a perverse kind of notion with the military where they think, well, if it really is just about where are they, we'll tell you where they are. And they came along and said, here, there's a hood in it, we do anything to see. And they expected that somehow perversity to be the end of the discussion, and of course it's not. So revelations like that one and new ID, new attempts to instigate limited truth measures with limited judicial effects, in fact, generate demand for question. So the relatives group said, well, yes, we wanted to know where they are, but now you've said you threw them to see, we want to know who threw them to see, and why did they throw them to see, and why aren't these people being put on trial? So demand kind of inflation happens within these new revelations. And new demands are also generated. These are images from around the time of Pinochet's death in 2006, but his conversion into a political corpse came much earlier with the revelations in 2004 about million-dollar secret bank accounts held in the Riksbank in the US, completely unrelated, both the revelation and the content, to human rights allegations. But the idea that he had salted away money made much more of an impact on the political right and the military than had his human rights record ever, and almost part of the really definitive shift in the image that Argentina, another example of the trajectory of re-eruption. In 1995, this book was published, Confessions of an Argentine Dirty Warrior. Adolfo Celingo came forward and confessed his participation in death flights, where drug prisoners were taken off into planes and thrown into the sea over the leather. So he is building the Esmeralda, one of the most emblematic torture sites in Argentina. This information was not new. This is not revelation. This is not something we never knew about. But there is something about the very public testimony of this from someone who had participated directly in it that really struck a chord in Argentina. And it led to the exposure of wider underlying social uncertainties. So madres and abuelos and mothers of grandchildren, mothers of the disappeared, used this to reinvigorate their campaign about missing children, children who had been born to political prisoners who we still don't know where they are and they're trying to trace, who were abducted by military family and raised as their own. On the back of the Celingo revelations and all that had brought up for people, they made an appeal. They have a genetic data bank, and they appeal to for young people around the ages who could possibly be the missing grandchildren they're still trying to trace to come forward and be genetically tested. And the response was that thousands and thousands of young people came forward, many more than